Succession number 21564, reel 15.
Colonel Cormac, reel 15. When you left Cyprus, you went back to Liverpool for a relatively short tour of duty. Why was that?
Well, I didn't really know exactly what's going to happen, but I was posted as a training a TA engineer group based in Liverpool as the group training major. And there I was responsible for the training of two port operating squadrons, one independent field squadron, and I worked closely with 107 Field Engineer Regiment, TA, which had its own regular training major, but we worked together in the same group. And I would normally have expected to do two and a half years with them. But before I left Cyprus, an application had gone forward for me to do a language course in Russian. And that, it so happened that after a few months in at Liverpool, I was called down to London for an interview about this language course. You want that to the whole story? Mm. And having been recommended in Cyprus, I didn't think there'd be any problem. But when I got to the MOD, the appropriate department, they looked at my application and said, well, you're actually too old for the language course as things stand at the present. We'd like people a bit younger and perhaps mentally agile enough to do the course. But they said, however, we've got a new test, a language aptitude test, has just come in from America, which we're going to introduce. It's based on a sort of artificial language, rather like Esperanto. And you start off with vocabulary and grammar notes, and it's graded throughout about 10, 12 pages of increasing difficulty. And you have to read the notes and the vocabulary and then answer there are some language questions and so on. It'll take about an hour, they said, and we'll see how you go. Well, I sat down and plowed my way through the paper and finished the thing in about the right time. The pass mark the Americans had said was pitched at about 40%, and I scored, quite fortuitously, something like 80%. And on the basis of that, they said, they really couldn't hold me back. And that I could go ahead, although I would be the oldest man in the course. So I returned to Liverpool and told my group commander that I would be going off to do a language course and my tour would be curtailed. I don't think he was best pleased, but I had a very interesting year with them.
I was going to ask you, were your units in this engineer group in Liverpool well recruited?
They were very well recruited that time. I say we had a curious thing. I had two port operating squadrons which had recently been converted from Royal Artillery coastal artillery squadrons. And they had one drill hall in Liverpool and one on the other side at Birkenhead, known locally as Birkenhead. And I also had a field squadron in Birkenhead, so I was in the area, covered quite a lot of ground. And there was 107 Field Engineer Regiment, and I had a good working relationship with them, although they had their own training major. And it was quite an interesting job, because I had to oversee the transition from rebadging from gunners to sappers, from coastal artillery to port operating squadrons, which, apart from the proximity of Liverpool docks, it couldn't have been further apart in terms of role and training and so on. And in fact, each of the drill halls had a saucer-like depression on the drill floor, which had in fact been the coastal artillery gun position. One in Liverpool pointed across to Birkenhead, and the other one pointed back, and between them they covered the entrance to the Mersey. And that was the theory, anyway. But they took to that quite well. They made the best of it and became quite enthusiastic. And so I had to teach them or arrange for them to be taught the elements of stevedoring, for example, and crane operating for running the docks. And the idea would be, and of course at that time there had been a history of trouble in the docks, particularly Liverpool, and it was thought a good idea to have these squadrons, in any case, trained to run ports, would come to of great assistance if the docks should shut down or go on strike. So I built a land ship from an old air raid shelter, a same length as a ship on dry land, and set up a mast and jibs and derricks and winches and a few other things like that to add interest. And they gradually got to know about loading and stowing stuff in holds and unloading and packing on the dock side, that sort of thing, and all the trades associated with running a port.
Roughly how long do you think it was before they became competent at loading and unloading?
Oh, it was still going on when I left.
What, the training?
The training, yeah. Yes. They were just getting used to the idea.
Yes.
Because they had to be regraded and then taught in various trades. Their annual camp was down at Marchwood, at the Royal, was then the Royal Engineers Inland Water Transport Base, where they had chance to practice on real ships in the real conditions, and that was their annual camp. And that proved very popular. They thoroughly enjoyed that, and one or two of them had a chance to do diving at the school, which was at Marchwood then. It all changed shortly afterwards. But they got into the swing of it.
What kind of backgrounds did these men come from? Were any of them actually dockers in civil life?
Very, very few, because bear in mind they had been gunners at one time, and therefore they were attracted a slightly different type of person from the normal dockyard workers. They were businessmen of various kinds. Some were school teachers, some were junior men, and some just some were unemployed. Who came along because they could actually earn a little bit of money with the TA, and it gave them an interest in life until they could pick up another job. So there was a considerable mixture of people. At that time, there was also a certain amount of weeding out in the TA. There had been a considerable portion, shall I put it this way, who had been a long time in the TA and whose idea of TA service was the social side rather than the work side. And a few of these old veterans were being weeded out and replaced by people who were keener on turning up for evening parades, weekend parades, and actually getting on with some work. And so they were a great mixture. At that time, there wasn't much trouble about getting leave from companies and firms who, in that area, tended to be quite supportive of the TA. And had a history of that, and people were encouraged to join, or if they said if they had an interest in joining the TA, they were helped as far as they could, and given time off without penalty. So that was nice. I also had one other squadron over on the far side, 113 Independent Field Squadron, which was a descendant, a linear descendant, if you like, of 113 Engineer Regiment, which had fought at Alamein. And one of their company commanders, as they were in those days, had devised a system which we still tend to use today of breaching minefields.
How was that done?
There's a famous painting in the Royal Engineers Mess at Brompton showing a chap called Stagg with a mine detector leading the way through the minefield at Alamein. And basically, they had a recce party, and they trailed out red white tapes behind them, and the two leading men with prodders and things went ahead, ran out of the tape behind them of a lane a meter or rather a yard wide in those days, and then they were followed up by prodders and mine detectors and breached the minefields that way. And in fact, until flail tanks came in and giant vipers and other devices that we have today, like the aardvark and the flail tanks and so on, and ploughs, that was the standard way of getting through minefields for many years thereafterwards, and is still a basis of mine clearing drills by hand. So they were very proud of that history, and they were very keen, and had some very good regular NCOs with them. So that was a variation. They were doing normal sapper training. At the same time, the other two squadrons were doing port operating, and occasionally I had to do with the regiment taking part on as umpiring schemes and that sort of thing. Then, in addition to all that sort of work, we ran study periods. And, of course, the great thing in those days was the effect of nuclear or atomic bombs. And so we had to do a lot of mugging up on what might happen then, danger zones, clouds, contamination areas, and the effect of an atomic bomb on Liverpool docks and where the fallout would take place. Study days to that end.
Did you then have some sort of civil defence role for that eventuality?
Not specifically. We would support the civil defence authorities should they want that. And that was just beginning to set up. There were these cells at various areas, and we were just working out modus operandi, if you like, as to what we could do. That was one of the many subjects of our study days. There were camps, Satan Camp near Chester, again, where people gathered and did their promotion exams for that matter. They had to pass a modified form of lieutenant to captain and captain to major promotion exam before they could get through. And so there was a certain amount of work to encourage them and help them on the way. And I think latterly, we then sent them on courses to Sandhurst, which may, I don't know if they still, TA courses still exist.
There still are.
There was a certain amount of work in that, getting people geared up to go down there and give them a chance to pass, A, to get a commission, and B, to get promotion at the appropriate level. So there was a lot to do to keep one occupied there.
Was your job mainly one of a general supervision of training?
Yes, that's right. I mean, and running training programs.
Yes.
And I had a very good team of Royal Engineer QMSIs and NCOs who were attached or seconded to the TA.
They were regulars, though.
They were all regulars. Yes. And they would encourage the TA NCOs to become instructors, but by and large, they did the training and they did most of the administrative work, making sure that they got out on weekends, that the transport was there, that the food was there. The administration, they took a great hand in that and made sure that that all worked when we went out to various training areas for exercises of various kinds. And they were an absolute tower of strength, picked specially for that job.
Were you able to get them out regularly at weekends? Were training weekends frequent?
Yes, they were... They had about two or three weekends a month, and they had a couple of evenings, and not everyone could make everything, but those that were going to be any use would have to attend about 80-odd percent of the drill periods and weekends that were available to make themselves worthwhile and to justify being in the TA. And the vast majority got down to it enthusiastically.
How long would an evening of training last? I mean, what
about
would be the
2 hours? And then there was a social bit afterwards.
Yes.
That was inevitable, but that was secondary to the training value.
2 hours of training, and then they would relax. What time of the evening would the training begin?
It was early evening, six to eight, thereabouts, 6:30 to 8:30, and then half an hour or so in the mess. Perhaps some would stay a bit longer, depending on if they were walking home or driving home. And there were many social functions in the messes. Guest nights, a couple of times a year, entertaining local people who are of influence, who could help further the TA cause. That sort of thing went on. And cocktail parties, receptions, they all, as a normal mess functions, they took place. And they were quite good at that.
How did the field squadron people get on with the new port operating companies who'd originally been coastal gunners? Did they meld together easily?
Well, they didn't actually have very much to do with them. Their whole training ethos was different. But they met at study periods, promotion exams and that sort of thing. They met then socially on group occasions. But otherwise, training was, I had to run a separate training program for them, separate places for them to train on the normal sapper things like demolitions, roads, minefields, water supply, the usual things.
Did they cover the whole field, or did you tend to give priority to one field sappering function or another in that training program?
Well, basically, they did the same syllabus as the regular sapper, but they only had to pass only a certain number of parts to get through. So they, realizing the time they had available, it was scaled down slightly. And one would hope, and I think that was realized, that when they had got through that and had done a year or two practicing it at the weekends and their annual camps, which were full time, that they could, with a few limitations, be as effective as the regular soldier. But it took a lot longer.
When they went out for a weekend, were they usually on their own, or did you ever combine them with other territorial formations or units?
They were mostly on their own. We didn't have formation, TA formation exercises, not in my time anyway.
Mm. Who was actually commanding the group? Was he a regular or was he a...
He was a regular sapper colonel, and his staff was a brigade major, although it was a group, and a DA QMG, and myself as the training major. That was the staff, plus a couple of two or three civilian clerks employed by the TA. The TA units themselves were a mixture of TA officers in command and regulars. The port operating squadrons mostly had TA officers running them. The field squadron mostly had a TA officer in charge. The engineer regiment alternated with a regular lieutenant colonel and a TA lieutenant colonel in charge, and they seemed to alternate and give the TA officer a chance to aim fairly high and that he could actually get somewhere in the end. And one or two of them went on to become full colonels in the TA on sort of assistant group commander, because the whole area was in those days was formed up into TA engineer brigades. Northwest and Northeast England basically had one brigade each with a regular brigade commander, and his deputy would be a TA full colonel. So that was a chance for them to go one level up. They were mainly to give the engineer regiment, the TA engineer regiment, more advanced training. And they had their own bridging camps at Halton, or they went to Germany, the BOR. Every other year, most of them went across to Germany for a camp, and that was very popular.
What was their mobilisation role? And presumably the field squadron had a mobilisation role.
Yes.
Would it have gone to Germany in the event of the balloon going up?
They were supposed to go to Germany, and so was the engineer regiment. And I did a recce down through till they went to Belgium. There was a big camp near Antwerp.
Emblem, would that have been?
Yes, and then they would stage there and then move into a camp, a field camp site near there, where all the engineer equipment would then they'd meet up with their BOR type equipment.
That would be in the zone of communications, wouldn't it?
That's right. And we had to practice that. But it was just being set up, and I did the recce to see what kit was there and how the staff at Emblem actually managed to make sure the vehicles would run when the TA arrived, because otherwise they were parked in sheds and vehicle yards, and all the other equipment was there. They had quite a responsibility at Emblem to run the machines, make certain they were in working order when the TA came, A, for their camp, or B, for real. And that needed looking at.
Who actually provided the staff for Emblem? Was that specifically engineer, or was it more generic?
It was all arms.
All arms.
It wasn't particularly engineer. It was a large engineer section. But I can't remember too much about how it was organized. I just remember going across there and looking at all the equipment and being told how they did it and how it would all be driven out to the open field campsite where the TA would meet up with their equipment.
But were these trucks and other things in mothballed in any way to preserve them in between use?
No, they weren't. They weren't. For that very reason, they had to be in running order. And no one knew then if the balloon would go up or when it would go up. I've no doubt that there would be a lot of equipment mothballed in overall chain, but at Emblem it was all theoretically ready to move at a moment's notice.
Did you exercise them in mobilisation movement?
Well, they were going to, but I left before that actually happened. So I don't know. Many years later I met them in BOR, or some TA regiments who'd been through the system, so I know it worked. But at that time, no, I didn't have a chance to do it personally. I started the thing off, if you like, and the initial reconnaissance and so on, and then plans were made to try it out. But from my point of view, sadly, they took place after I left.
Do you have any memory of how long it was expected to take to get the company from Liverpool and out into its field camp near Emblem, once the word had been given? What was the sort of mobilisation time you had in mind?
Difficult to say, because we had to come down by train and then take the ferry across to Belgium. It was all done by train and boat then. I imagine that the thing will have changed and they'll do it by aeroplane now, but that it's all changed. The whole concept has changed so dramatically that I can't really comment now. But it was a fairly comparatively slow business to get them into the centres and then onto the proper trains, which would be called up, and then down to the ferry site across to Antwerp, and then on into Germany.
Do you remember where they'd have set off from for Antwerp? Would it have been an east coast port or...?
Well, I went across from the normal ferry... From Dover to Ostend.
Yes,
That was supposedly the same route that they would take.
So it had been Dover, Ostend by sea, and then land movement up to Antwerp.
Yeah. Yes. And that may have been modified, and according to the trains and timing, once they tried the system out. I mean, in many ways, one would have thought that perhaps Harwich or the newer ports there would have been more suitable. But that was a longer sea journey.
Yes.
So you had to balance out the speed of the train and the short journey, and then the distance to travel on the other end. Rather like planning a holiday, in fact. You decide which way to go, and then you modify it in the light of experience.
Do you know what they would have done after they'd arrived in their field camp near Antwerp? Would they have gone forward, further forward into...
They would have gone forward to a reserve position. Because I can... remember later on, when I was in BOR, that we had to make arrangements to receive the TA forces when they came in, and they had areas designated where they would come and land and meet up again with stores. There was a great place at Senelager training camp, I remember, and that's looking ahead a few years.
Yes.
But we had them there. And then I was looking at that time, I was looking at more from a NATO point of view than a purely BOR point of view, because they would be mixing with reserve forces of other countries. But that's another story.
Were they destined for any particular division, or were they would they have been corps troops, do you know?
They would be corps troops, certainly. I think that was modified again to give them encouragement to come forward to divisional troops, but I recall, as far as I recall, they were definitely corps troops until they had settled down, got themselves organised, fitted into the framework, as it were, and got used to the staff systems in operation, and then things may have changed, but there was a considerable role for them in field engineering at corps troop level.
And what about the port operating companies, or squadrons rather? Would they have remained in Liverpool to operate the port there, or would they have gone abroad on mobilisation?
They were essentially to help operate the ports in the UK. There wasn't, as I recall, any need for special ports, because the emphasis would be on BOR and Europe, yes. Northwest Europe. Yes. There were ports in existence. And it may be that they could be called forward to help rehabilitate ports that were severely damaged. That was a possibility, but it wasn't part of their role at that time, because it would take, had they'd only just converted from being coastal gunners, It would take a year or two before the ethos and the training levels were adequate for them to do that sort of work.
So they were still really in the process of conversion when
That's
you
right.
left them.
And I'd say most of them accepted the change and rebadging quite cheerfully, but there were always one or two who could not get used to the idea that they weren't gunners anymore and tended to rather stick to the old ways or resent the change. But they were in the minority.
When you left Liverpool and went down to the Army Language School
at Beaconsfield,
you passed their test in London, you went off to Beaconsfield, and you spent, was it 2 years there learning Russian?
It was a year and a half.
Year and a half.
Approximately. The first 9 months or so, nearly a year, was at Beaconsfield, getting a grounding in the course, in the language, grammar, vocabulary, conversation. And the staff there were a mixture of British instructors and teachers, more probably appropriately, and people from Eastern Europe. There was one Russian, Soviet army officer who had defected, who became an instructor there for some years before he went somewhere else and took up a new life. There were several Poles, and there was and those who had experience of the language at first hand. So quite a mixture of staff there. And the Russian, and he was very punctilious about getting pronunciation exactly right. The others were more concerned that you should be able to speak and communicate. But he was very, I remember him particularly, he was very pernickety about getting it right. So there was a mixture of Russian, Soviet Army officer, Poles, who were there, had been in some cases for many years.
What method of instruction was used?
It was basically classroom instruction in small groups, a mixture of just basic language, and it was all graded with difficult, you know, increasing difficulty as you went through. The emphasis, as far as possible, was on being able to say a few words as early as possible and getting used to that.
What's the emphasis on oral language rather than written?
Both, very much so. We had to do a considerable amount of written work for the interpreter's exam, because that's what we were aiming at. It was geared up to the first 3 months or 6 months were colloquial level, and you had to pass the colloquial exam, which had some financial reward. And then you moved on to the interpreter's exam. One or two of the brighter people got first-class interpreters, but the majority of us were happily settled for second-class interpreters. But that did require quite a lot of written work. And it was done by essays, or translating paragraphs from English into Russian and Russian into English. And then there was the usual dictation, when people would read a passage out to you once, and then they would read it slowly, and you had to quickly write down the English version of that or the Russian version of that. So there were those two written works, and then there was an oral exam, Aviva.
How many people were there in the class?
Our group must have been about 20, approximately. And we were in two groups or three groups of 7 to 10 or seven or eight in a group. Nice small numbers, and you got to know people quite well, and it gave you more confidence and more chance to speak. Had the groups been bigger, that would have been more difficult to get adequate speaking time, as it were.
How much time, roughly, did you have for private study as opposed to instructional time?
Well, the instruction was Monday to Thursday was 9 o'clock till about 4:30 or 5 with a break. There were a couple of evenings a week when you went